Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening and welcome to an encore presentation of the Voice of Indie podcast. Tonight's episode is a replay of our short story episode. So the phone lines will be closed, but we will see you again or hear from you again next week. Enjoy this encore presentation.
It's time for Voice of Indie. Your hosts today are Beam Weeks, author, producer, and marketing monster for independent multimedia publisher Fresh Ink Group, and Stephen Gies, author, producer, composer, and publisher for Fresh Ink Group.
Okay, well, that was interesting. They just didn't want to play. But that's what happens sometimes on live radio. So I'm your host, Beam Weeks, and with me tonight, as always, is co-host Stephen Gies. How you doing, Stephen?
I'm doing great. How about you, Beam?
I can't complain. We have a really cool show up tonight, but why don't you tell the people how they can become involved?
Okay, well, first off, if you're on Twitter, up in the search bar, type in hashtag Fresh Ink Group, and you can post questions or comments there for us, see what other people are saying. Today's episode is a short story episode. We're going to talk about short stories, short fiction, and we're going to have three readings for you today.
Yeah, short stories.
That thing is being rather persnickety, isn't it?
Yes, it is. I hear you kind of cutting in and out, but well, that's all right. We'll get this done. We'll get through it. But as you mentioned, this is a short story special episode. As both a reader and a writer, some of my most favorite stories that I've read have been short stories. In fact, there are some that I read over 40 years ago. We talked about this the other night off air. But these are stories that still stick with me and they resonate with me because these authors were able to put such a powerful message in just a, you know, basically what amounts to a handful of words compared to a novel. And I've always loved the short story medium. And I think this is long overdue, kind of putting this out there on the front lines, and let's have a good time with us.
Right now, we're trying to draw attention to our short story contests, which you can access through freshinkgroup.com. We're putting out our second and third anthology collections, the Fresh Ink Group Short Story Showcase. We already have number one out. We're working on number two and three. You got a commercial for us, Beam?
I do.
Writers, got a short story looking for a prestigious anthology that will showcase your work alongside other top authors? Or maybe you've experienced a moment worth sharing, perhaps with some poignant meaning we could all appreciate? Fresh Ink Group is accepting submissions for our second and third volumes of the Fresh Ink Group Short Story Showcase to be released worldwide in hardcover, softcover, and all ebook formats. There are no fees to enter. Winners are not only published, but are eligible to become members of Fresh Ink Group with your own dashboard in the freshinkgroup.com website. Head on over to freshinkgroup.com contest tab to learn more. Then grease up the old Underwood and get those shorts down on parchment so you can get your entries in sooner than later. And you readers, discover 49 wondrous tales already released in the Fresh Ink Group Short Story Showcase number 1, available in all formats worldwide.
Yeah, Fresh Ink Group Short Story Anthology number 1. That's been out for a while, and we're going to have a reading from that one. You want to tell us a little bit about this particular story and the author?
Boy, I had a tough time picking because when we met last night, and by the way, your two hosts are about 800 miles apart, so we don't see each other or signal each other or anything. So when we had our meeting on Skype last night to plan this, we agreed that I would do a reading and add some music and sound effects of one of the short stories that's in that first showcase. So I thought, ah, piece of cake, you know, I'll pick out a story and spend a half hour reading it, edit it, throw in some sounds and have some fun with it. And then I had to pick one. And I wound up rereading about half that book, I think, because so many of those stories are good. I kept picking a story, and then it was like, oh, well, this one might be a little bit long for the time we have. Maybe I should pick another one. And then I'd go start reading another one. And I'm the one who edited them, so I remember all the stories. But, man, there's just so many good stories there and so many good writers. I really did have a tough time. I wound up going with a story called In Love and Chocolate by Talia Tate Berner. She's a lady in Texas. She submitted, I think like 15 stories back when we were doing this first contest. And every one of them was fantastic. I wanted to put every one of them in the book, but we couldn't do that. Couldn't do that, of course, although I do need to look her up again and have a talk with her, and maybe we could put some in a book for her. But out of these, we wound up putting three of her stories in the book. So out of all the people who submitted, she got more in that 49 than anybody else. I don't know that much more to say about her other than she's a fantastic writer, and we need to talk again soon. So this is In Love and Chocolate by Talia Tate Berner, narrated by me, Stephen Gies.
In Love and Chocolate by Talia Tate Berner, Texas, USA. Uncle Rex and Aunt Frances lived in a single wide at the edge of a cotton field on the home place. It was surrounded by a little stand of pine trees adjacent to Nana and Papa's house. Both of these particulars made the place extra special. Cottonwoods and pecans were plentiful in Mississippi County, but a grove of pine trees was a rare sight. I often wondered if my uncle planted those trees, or perhaps they grew from seeds Nana tossed from her back porch, much like Jack's enchanted beanstalk. I never thought to ask anyone. The inside of their home was as special as the outside. The air was altered, unruffled, protected. The tiny kitchen often held a freshly baked surprise, gooey brownies, chocolate chip cookies, or chocolate pie piled high with meringue. A massive console stereo spanned the entire living room wall, anchoring the trailer into the dirt, commanding attention without being obnoxious. Running my index finger softly over the polished wood surface from end to end, I always felt the urge to lower my head and make the sign of the cross, even though I was a Southern Baptist. A hidden altar on our farm, it lured us inside the calm inner sanctum, offering a brief respite from the mud pies and sweaty games of tag. It's where I first learned of Patsy Cline. Their amazing album collection was stacked neatly within the adjoining cabinet, arranged much like the cool display at my favorite record shop on Main Street. My sister and I spent hours thumbing through covers, studying the artists, memorizing lyrics, and we were allowed to play those albums unattended, placing the needle of the record player arm just so, careful not to scratch the vinyl. We listened to Crazy over and over until the words burned into our brains like a beloved church hymn. Singing off-key and loudly, we perfected somersaults on the gold shag carpeting in front of the sofa. I was amazed at how such a small home could be spacious enough to accommodate tumbling. It was always spotless. Uncle Rex and Aunt Frances had no children to mess it up, other than my sister and me. As a kid, I wasn't aware of my uncle's little secret. Later, I learned Uncle Rex was an addict. He was madly hooked on Aunt Frances and chocolate. In that order. He was lost without Frances. Adrift, disoriented, crazy, physically ill, as if part of his being had dissolved. Part that kept him happy and focused and stable, the part that made him him, that held his chocolate addiction in balance. Thank God they were rarely apart, but sometimes it was unavoidable. One particular summer, Frances willingly agreed to donate a kidney to her ailing sister. To Uncle Rex's dismay, the transplant team wouldn't hear of performing the surgery from their single wide, no matter how clean. A temporary separation was inevitable. It would only be a few days, insurance saw to that, but even so, Uncle Rex was anxious. Sunday morning from the pulpit, scanning the faces of his devoted but sparse congregation, Pastor Brown inquired, "Are there any announcements? Any sick we need to add to the prayer list?" The overhead fans did little to stir the hot air inside the sanctuary. It was a steamy day. "Please keep praying for my brother-in-law. Doc says there's nothing more they can do. Hospice is scheduled to come in this week." The members were sympathetic, sadly nodding, a few friends murmuring with heads together, almost touching. The word hospice always brought a sense of finality. "Sister Sue wants us to pray for her brother-in-law," Pastor Brown repeated in his compassionate, commanding preacher voice, making sure everyone heard the plea. From near the back pew came a high-pitched appeal. "Rebecca had her baby, a little girl, but she's still in NICU over in Memphis. Been there 2 weeks now. Let's everyone pray for Sister Rebecca and her newborn daughter." Pastor Brown added these souls to the growing list, waving his hymnal for emphasis. "We need to pray for Rex Creasy. Sister Frances is fixing to give a kidney to her sister. You know, he's lost without her. Couldn't even get him to come to church this morning," reported a concerned church member from the choir loft. Everyone glanced to the empty place he and Frances always sat each Sunday, their pew. The church family nodded in unison. Again, sad, low mumbling. "Yes, everyone be sure to pray for Brother Creasy. He will need strength to make it through Sister Frances' procedure." And that's how it was. Everyone knew she would be fine, and everyone knew he would worry himself sick in her absence. By the end of evening prayer meeting, the good Southern church ladies had activated the casserole phone tree with the skill and precision of a military operation. A steady stream of china platters and covered crock pots began flowing onto the Red Formica kitchen table and spilling over to the countertop and stove. Food of wakes and funerals. Food to sustain and distract Uncle Rex. Food to make the church ladies feel useful. Chicken and dressing, piles of spaghetti with meatballs, macaroni and cheese, buttermilk biscuits with fresh pear preserves, a coconut pie, gallon jugs of sweet tea, and green jello salad, the kind with pieces of pecans. And Sister Laverne made her famous homemade 5-layer triple chocolate cake. Uncle Rex never gave a thought to the other church lady food, only Sister Laverne's famous homemade 5-layer triple chocolate cake held his attention. It was moist and creamy, with a drizzle of raspberry fudge sauce along the sides and a light-handed dusting of powdered sugar around the top. A tantalizing, gastronomical work of art. As soon as Sister Laverne took her leave on his back stoop, saying, "Okay now, you call if you need anything, anything at all," he slammed the door and hastily peeked inside the cake cover, drawing the chocolate aroma fully into his lungs. Before her dusty Chevrolet backed to the end of the gravel driveway, the kitchen was cloaked in the heavenly smell of warm milk chocolate and vanilla buttercream. And a hint of almond? His acute senses were awakened. Falling back into the chair, weakened, he allowed himself only a small sliver and a bit of icing. No need for a plate. The first taste was rich and velvety on his tongue. His pulse quickened. Unable to savor the slice, he quickly devoured it. Swathed in euphoria, the sensation lingered. With great difficulty, he replaced the lid to the Tupperware cake cover, snapping and sealing it shut, then relocated it high above the refrigerator by using a small step stool. Away, away. He knew to be careful with chocolate. A better plan would have been to remove it from the trailer altogether. Sleep wouldn't come. His heart raced as if beating outside his body, growing quicker and quicker and louder every instant. As he tossed, his legs became entangled and twisted in the bed sheets. the television offered no distraction. An old black and white movie combined with the chocolate in his mind only added to the maddening suspense. He played an old favorite album on his console, but the music was more noisy than soothing. The cake called. Weekend, he sat alone at the kitchen table, the trailer shrouded by pine trees throwing odd shadows along the walls. A thin, dim ray cast from a giant moon gleamed like the thread of a spider upon the triple chocolate dessert. Thrusting his finger deep into the frosting, he tasted it again. Luscious. Then he began to eat.
Yay!
He ate. The heady aroma consumed him. A groan of ecstasy escaped from somewhere within him.
Oh.
He ate the entire cake in one sitting. One decadent bite after another until the cake plate was empty, but for a few moist crumbs. Like the eyes of a madman, his pale blue rolled back into his head. His heart raced. He collapsed into bed, intoxicated, crazed, drunk on chocolate. The clock struck 4. He awoke with excruciating chest pain, extreme pressure on his rib cage. His breathing was shallow, his arm numb. I'm having a heart attack. True. Nervous. Very, very nervous. I'm being punished for being so pathetic, for having no willpower. It is done. Sirens wailed, lights flashed. The faces of neighbors showed as lights swiftly passed across farmhouse windows, their dreams interrupted. Emergency technicians tried to calm him. His sugar levels were strangely and dangerously elevated. He was frenzied and agitated. Finally, he slept. Dreamless. Black. Sleep. A bright light. The light drew him up and away from unconsciousness. He followed it. A sense of calm. I have died. Am I in heaven? Rex, can you hear me? He heard a distant yet familiar voice. God, is that you? God sounded oddly like Dr. Reggie. Slowly, through the lingering dark chocolate fog, his physician came into view. He flickered a pen light into his dilated pupils, back and forth, nearly blinding him. I've never had a patient overdose on chocolate cake. He chuckled heartily. Rex's head pounded as he remembered his embarrassing night of gluttony. Homemade, 5-layer, triple, chocolate, cake.
Yay!
Where's Francis? He asked Dr. Reggie, his mouth dry and swollen, lips chapped. The machinery around him hummed and flashed periodically, the noises magnified in the sterile room. They'll be bringing her back from recovery soon. She did great. That'll be her bed over there. He pointed to the empty bed next to him, only a few feet away. Sunlight streamed through the window. Dust motes danced, suspended midair. He smiled and dozed. He was back where he belonged.
And there you go, In Love and Chocolate by Talia Tate Berner, as read by Stephen Gies. Good job, Stephen. Cool with the sound effects and whatnot.
It's the way that we do audiobooks, except the big difference here is we use professional narrators rather than trying to do the voiceovers ourselves. believe me, I'm not a professional narrator. Never thought I was. Frankly, no blank show. But yeah, that was a lot of fun. Throwing some sound effects, lighthearted, and the music just to give it some atmosphere. Talia Tate Berner is definitely a phenomenal writer, and I recommend that you check out that story, plus her other two stories in Fresh Ink Group Short Story Showcase number 1.
Yeah.
Also, I think it'll be on YouTube and the Fresh Ink Group channel sometime this evening.
Yeah, I'll get to that. I'll probably be putting that up sometime before I go to bed tonight. Yeah, short stories. that anthology is just loaded with them. And if you're a writer out there and you write short stories, you want to make sure you submit one of your stories, or two or three of them, or as like Talia did, 15 of them. And you might have a shot at being in the next anthology or two. So, you know, keep that in mind.
Got a quick reminder here. If you're on Twitter, go to hashtag Fresh Ink Group, and you can post a question or a comment, or put up your favorite picture of your cat, whatever you want. So our next story here is one by Beam Weeks, and it's read by him too. Why don't you tell us about it, Beam?
This one comes from my short story collection, Strange Highway. This is my second collection of short stories that I've had published. And this is a story that was inspired by something I had seen on TV probably 12, 15 years ago. It was actually from an episode of Celebrity Rehab. It was the mother of the late singer of Alice in Chains, Lane Staley. His mother was on there. And she spoke of when they knew he wasn't going to live. They knew he wasn't, years before he died, because he had become so caught up in heroin addiction and among other drugs. And she spoke on there about when they discovered that he was dead, and he had been dead in his condo for, they speculate, maybe 14 days, something like that, if I'm remembering correctly. But he had been dead for a while. And so they had the police break down the door, and she said that before they took the body out, she pulled out a chair and sat down next to his body and just basically let out all of her emotions. She spoke to him. She had her final conversation with her son. He was dead and gone, but she had hoped that maybe his spirit was lingering in that room and he would hear what she had to say. She was angry that he was gone and angry that he had done this to himself, but she still loved him so much and missed him. And this is what kind of inspired this story, which is coming out of Strange Highway. But I think maybe we should roll the Strange Highway promo first, Stephen.
I think so.
Okay, so this story, we'll roll the story here after the promo, but it can be found in Strange Highway.
If you ever find yourself on the Strange Highway, don't turn around. Don't panic. Just keep going. You never know what you'll find. Could be an autistic young man conjuring magic with his fingers. Or one girl's afternoon leading to a lifetime of loss. Demon or angel. A winged man revealing his true nature. A mother's recognition bringing closure to her daughter. Sudden death of a teen boy stifling burgeoning secrets. Black man's guitar transforming one young boy. Decades-old accident bringing a desperate confession. Supernatural first love healing a broken family. Head on down the Strange Highway and see more stories unfold. Need a ride? This book will get you there. Catch an e-book or get on the bus with a nice print edition you can hold and keep. Perhaps a full-sized trade paperback. Or ride in style with your own dust-jacketed hardcover. Fresh Ink Group's got you covered. You can exit the Strange Highway and come back anytime you want. You see, now you know the way in. Don't be a stranger.
All right, so as I was saying about the story, the short story is constant as the day. And it's just one of those things where, what would you say to that? You know this loved one is caught up in addiction and they're not going to be around, and you find out that they've passed and you've got an opportunity to speak to them even though they're dead. What would you say? Now this story is from the point of view of the mother, and I read it, and I'm not like Stephen has said just a little while ago, I'm not a professional voiceover person. But if we ever did this as a actual audiobook, we would have a woman read this part. But I did it, and like I said, it's not very professional, and there's no sound effects in it. There's a little bit of music, but I didn't put the sound effects in it. But it's just a straight read, so this is constant as the day, and I hope you enjoy it. That's what your grandmother used to say. Constant as the day. You probably don't remember that, though. She died before you were old enough to appreciate her wisdom. It just means that certain things in life will never change, no matter the consequences. I saw you go in there this afternoon, into your bedroom closet, the way you've done 1,000 times before. This time was different. The air lacked its charge, that spark your presence always added. I guess I expected this moment. God knows most of the family had already accepted it. But acceptance doesn't come easy to a mother. That you'd be the one to deny me grandchildren, that had been established long ago. I know. I have 3 other children. There will be plenty of little ones running around the house again one day. It's just so far from what I imagined for you. I always blamed myself, though deep inside I know it's not my fault. Did I neglect you in some way? Is the divorce the determining factor in the road you chose? Just remember, your father left us. I didn't have any say in that decision. Still, here we are. You lie on the floor inside the closet, the way you've done since childhood. When you'd sneak inside and fall asleep while hiding. I remember the frantic search that first time. We scoured the house and the yard looking for you. Nobody thought to peer inside the closet. Maybe we'd been subconsciously afraid of the bones we hoped would remain hidden. It's there beside you, that dirty spoon and stub of a candle. You didn't even last long enough to pull the needle out of your arm. At first I saw those as tools of the devil. Those were the things that changed you from a happy little girl into a brooding young woman so filled with darkness. It didn't happen overnight, though. The pallor of your skin is highlighted by the deep purple where the blood has pooled against your left cheek, the telltale sign it no longer flows through your body, keeping you warm, keeping you alive. Everything for you has stopped. Your heart, your mind, your potential. Not to sound morbid, but I pictured this moment 100 times over the years. Even before I touch your face, I know what awaits my fingertips. The first time you overdosed, I blamed myself. The second time, I blamed God. The third time, well, I realized God was just as sad as me. It's why I always looked in on you, seeing you on the closet floor. I'd count the times your chest would rise and fall in a minute, hoping that 1 minute would lead to a second, and then to another. Until you'd open your eyes. I don't know what happened today. Or maybe I do know. Either way, I just couldn't look in on you this time. I didn't have it in me to count 1 more minute. I made plans for you. I know, you had your own ideas, but mine were better, healthier. My plan saw you falling in love with a nice boy, a boy you'd want to hold on to forever. I used to think Jeffrey Kellen might be that boy, the way you used to look at him whenever he'd happened by the house, always at dinner time. But then he went away, Iraq, as I recall. When he returned home in that bag, I just knew that was probably it for you. You were just too delicate to cope with another loss so close on the heels of your father leaving us. I hate that you're cold now, and there's nothing I can do to warm your body. You just don't understand how unnatural this moment is for a mother. I hate you as much as I love you. I wasn't a mother until you. And you weren't expected either. No, ma'am. Your father and I, we had no intentions of parenthood so soon into our marriage. We planned the first 10 years of our time together, the way musicians plot out their intended rise to world domination. We were meant to see Europe, Asia, maybe hit the lower 48. But then you changed all of that, to the delight of my mother. Then came the other 3. And your father, he decided he was still young enough to do Europe, with the babysitter. You don't look like you. Not now. The soul is gone, and all that remains is a shell, a husk, a thing to be discarded, removed away like some secret family shame meant to stay hidden. Inside your closet, I crouch beside you, stroking your hair, tracing your cold lips with the tips of my fingers, the way I did when you were 2 and 3 and 4 years old and couldn't, or wouldn't, fall asleep. It used to drive your father crazy. Just leave her be, he'd argue. She'll get tired on her own. He was in love with me back then. He saw you as a sort of competitor, a threat to his time alone with me. I would have died for you, but you wouldn't let me. That you've broken my heart is a given, but that's the curse of parenthood. We give you life, invent notions of what and who you'll be, and you turn our worlds upside down, becoming a junkie without aim, without reason, without a thought for what you've done to us, to me. I resent you for the call I must make. What am I supposed to say to these people? How do I phrase such a conversation? Do I say, hello, my oldest child has passed away from an overdose. Would you please come and retrieve the body before her siblings get home from school? The thing that amazes me the most is the calm tone of my own voice as I say those very words into my cell phone. It's almost a matter-of-fact discussion between me and the woman on the other end. Lynette, I say, when they ask the name of my deceased child, Lynette Grace Priner. We named her after my mother and her father's sister. They care nothing for the intimate details of your existence. Heroin, I explain, when they ask of a potential cause for your demise. We tried rehab, twice. Again, this last bit of information means nothing to the voice on the other end of this conversation. 21 years, that's all we'll know of you in this world. I want to cry. I need to cry. But that's just not happening today. Not now, at least. You've drained me of my tears since the first time I knew you'd chosen this path. I just don't have it in me to shed one more. Perhaps when we put you in the ground. I'll miss you, the way a parent ought to miss a lost child. But I will not be bound by emotional necessities. You're gone, and nothing can bring you back. Please don't think me cruel, but I am alive. I am resurrected from the grave. I need no longer to pine for my wayward daughter. Nothing more can happen to you in this world. Your death is my salvation. It is a burden removed. I am free to live once more. And that one there is called Constant as the Day. And as I said, that is available in Strange Highway, my short story collection. And speaking of short story collections, Mr. G's, you've recently released a short story collection of your own, your first.
My first short fiction, Comes This Time to Float.
So, yes, you have a collection of essays. But this is your first short fiction called Comes This Time to Float. So, and you have a short story from that. We've got a couple to choose from, but we'll let you tell us about the book itself first.
Well, Comes This Time to Float is 19 short fiction. They tend to be literary, and they were written all probably over the last 20, 25 years, something like that, just whenever I'd get requested to write one, or a literary journal would need one or something like that. And when I got up to 19 of them, I thought, oh, geez, that looks like a book. So we put out a book, and we've got a promo for it. You got that, Beam?
I sure do.
Prepare to think as you explore these 19 short stories by author, composer, and producer Stephen Gies. Avoiding any single genre, this collection showcases Jesus' storytelling from literary to Southern Gothic to coming of age, allegory, humor, and even fantasy, all finessed to say something about who we are and what we see. Some of these tales have been passed around for years, others so virgin they have never known the seductive gaze of a reader's eyes. Now, you can go digital, Kindle, Nook, Kobo, iTunes, Google Play, and more, or you can keep it soft with a paperback to whip out in mixed company. Or you can really show off, be the envy of your crowd with a dust jacket and hardcover. Fresh Ink Group is where it's coming from. Amazon and the rest are where it's at. Just point and click, and you too can feel the electric surge of the latest from Stephen G's. So when life's currents get to pulling too hard, don't fight it. Just open the book and discover 19 new ways of going with the flow. Because now, more than ever, comes this time to float.
Okay, and as I had stated, you've actually got two short story readings racked up here. Which one do you want to go with? We've got Sidekick and we've got Busboy.
I think we're going to have time for Sidekick. I want to point out real quick to everybody, those commercials that you hear us rolling in, those are actual video commercials, and they're in the Fresh Ink Group channel on YouTube. So if you're liking the commercials, get over there and watch the whole commercial rather than just hearing the audio part. Okay, this short story here is called Sidekick. It's about a superhero and his sidekick, sort of. And it asks us to consider, what are superheroes? What kind of people are heroes? And what kind of people are sidekicks? Beam?
All righty. Here is Sidekick.
This Time to Float, 19 Short Stories by Stephen G's, a Fresh Ink Group audiobook narrated by the author. Yes, it's me. The first story is called Sidekick. I wrote this when a favorite literary journal asked me for a short. It has appeared in several places since. Oh, what differences we can make in the lives of others and ourselves as well. Sidekick, short fiction by Stephen G's. I just figured out something all superheroes should know about our sidekicks. I happened upon my own sidekick long before I grew up and stepped into the role of hero, way back when I was just a regular suburban kid with no inkling of my destiny as the savior of countless lives. Never a fan of those other heroes who star in their own comic books, I had no idea what a sidekick is supposed to do, let alone how much I would even need one. And now, after decades working with my own sidekick for the common good, something has gone horribly wrong, and the blood is coming too fast, the injuries too severe, time too short. It's breaking my heart that our era as superhero and sidekick is about to end. I was 9 or 10 years old when the world's most unlikely wannabe sidekick and his single-parent mom moved to our town. They set up housekeeping in that leaky rat's nest of an old farmhouse down the dirt road where overgrown fields pushed feebly against encroaching scrub. 2 years younger than I, skinny and smallish for his age, he tried to look passable in tattered second-hand clothes, usually sized too big or too small. Ever the bully magnet, he liked to pedal around on his chain-throwing rattletrap bicycle, a mismatch of old parts he'd scavenged. Since I was the only boy who didn't taunt him or push him down, he got to where he'd follow me about, hoping to join in while I hung out with others, but mostly content to hover at the periphery. He knew his place, but never acted resentful, instead appearing grateful for the tolerated proximity. No matter how much I ignored him, though, he often seemed to be watching me intently, studying me, as if appraising something only he could see. Catching me alone with nowhere particular to go one day, he said he had a secret to tell me. He looked around as if worried someone might approach with bad intent. "Not here," he whispered. Now, as piqued as preteen boys are about mysteries, they're just as skeptical of other boys' promises of intrigue, except that he looked so serious my curiosity won out.
Just tell me, I insisted, but he wiped his nose on his sleeve, then simply looked me straight in the eyes and waited, for once not looking so jumpy and scared. So for privacy, we rode our bikes out to his place, where we found his mom outside, standing beside the house, staring blankly at a jumble of rotting planks, apparently perplexed about the scrap pile's dilemma. Her hair a dirty tangle, clothes on backwards or inside out, she appeared to be lost, or maybe drunk, or even insane. Embarrassed, he dropped his bicycle and urged me to stay back, then approached her cautiously, maybe afraid of spooking her. He took her by the arm, whispered assurances, and led her up to the partly collapsed porch. As if finally recognizing her surroundings, she pushed the door open slowly, focused on him a moment, then drifted inside. I watched through a window as he eased her into a chair, then brought her a glass of water, her hands trembling as she drank. He waited until she settled back and closed her eyes. Where does the picked on boy retreat for his own reassurance when he's the one caring for his grown-up? He led me to the big shed beyond the house. He'd cleaned it up, arranged some stick furniture, added several stacks of faded superhero comic books, and achieved a rather clubhouse-like atmosphere. He offered me some crackers from a box and poured cups of Kool-Aid from a jug, ice cubes from a cooler under the table. We kicked back, at which time I proceeded to ask any normal 10-year-old's next question. His cheeks flushed. Tugging at his loose shoelace until it broke, he finally admitted, "She's all right if she takes her medicine, but she can't get 'em when no doctors show up at the clinic. Not taking 'em regular makes the in-betweens worse than never taking 'em at all." That proved a problem I couldn't solve, so I switched to the main subject. "That's not the secret, is it?" He shook his head, then stopped fidgeting long enough to look me straight in the eyes again, pausing as if weighing how much he really trusted me. He took a deep breath, lowered his voice, and said, "I got a superpower." Oh, jeez. I eyed the comic books and snorted my disapproval, then decided I might as well have some fun with this. "So, I got superpowers, too." His eyes widened, and he offered the hint of a grin. "Oh, good. You already know." "Yeah, I know everything in the universe." His shoulders slumped. "Oh, making fun of me." I put my hands up. "Sorry. Okay, but you gotta explain first." He wrinkled his nose and rubbed his forehead, then looked me right in the eyes for a third time. "You can make fun of me, but it won't change the truth. I can see, well, my power is I can see other people's powers." "Everybody has some?" "Well, just you so far. In everybody else, I can see what they don't have." "Just me, huh?" "Yep," he confirmed, getting up to gaze out the window toward his house. He turned and stood in front of me. "You're going to be a superhero someday, and I'm going to be your sidekick." I started out amused, then for some odd reason, annoyed. "Don't tell anybody that," I warned. I mean, I didn't care if he was crazy as his mom. I just didn't need anybody thinking I was, too. After that day, I mostly avoided him, though he still persisted at the periphery, practically wearing a "Victimize Me" sign. I even acted mean toward him a few times just to go along with the crowd, but it always left me feeling bad. It gets kind of hard to show your worst to someone who keeps insisting he sees good in you. Every time he found a chance at brief privacy, he reminded me he'd be my sidekick whenever I was ready. I didn't get why this mattered so much to him, this skinny little pest who always seemed just a bit off. Then one day, Todd talked me into riding our bikes out to the kid's place to mess with him a bit. Nothing too bad. We found him in his clubhouse, the place vandalized. He was sitting on the floor in the corner, knees up, hugging his legs, rocking, and crying. He looked up, revealing a bloody nose and brow, face scuffed. Todd wanted no part of getting blamed for beating him up, so he immediately took off while I stayed and helped the kid clean himself up, ice from his cooler on the swollen eye, band-aids over a cut on his arm. Then I went on a hunt for the offending Rue brothers, and despite improbable odds tilted only by my rage and determination, I left them also in need of ice and band-aids, both powerfully motivated to avoid further reprisals for messing with my sidekick. He thinks I saved him that day, and though I did make his life a lot better in how he got treated by others, in truth, I'm the one whose life changed the most. See, without even starting to believe in the absurd notion of superpowers, I did get hooked on the idea of stepping up when someone needed my help. And look how many lives I've saved in the years since, and how many more I've improved because my sidekick never relented in reminding me to pursue my better self. I took a lot of heat during my teen years for letting him tag along so much, but he never really seemed to have any other friends. Then when his mom got so bad there for a while, somebody had to make sure he got enough to eat and had a warm place to crash, especially while lowlifes were taking all-night advantage of her in that leaky rat's nest of an old farmhouse. Even superheroes have a regular life, a public persona, the need to walk among others without attracting too much attention. So I registered for a dorm room when I started college some 100 miles away. My sidekick followed, despite being under legal age, living here and there, working odd jobs, a child of opportunity and necessity. When I took an apartment second year, he stayed mostly at my place, a tremendous help around the house so I could concentrate on my studies. He spent most of his spare time making a fairly good living, cooking and cleaning and running errands and laundering and servicing cars for some of the more well-to-do students. He always put me first, though. Not that I asked him to. No, I never asked, and I did try not to take advantage of him. Those times I maybe sort of did, he seemed not only to understand, but to appreciate the opportunity. Seems that when someone is also working hard to help you achieve your goals, your accomplishments become his too. And if you try to make him stop, it hurts you both. He followed me across the country when I started med school. He proved so successful at his enterprise, he managed to help me and still earn enough from others to score a good place to live and cover his simple tastes. He even temporarily helped me out with a short-term loan once or twice, or maybe three times. Now, during the year or so Donna lived with me, she kept trying to take advantage of his good nature. I resented this because she didn't need the help, her chief pursuits being to coast through a couple of easy undergrad classes, spend her daddy's money on clothes, and spin fantasies about being married to a rich doctor someday. My alternate future that didn't hew to the superhero plan. I did come close to telling her the truth a few times, how I secretly nurtured superpowers so my sidekick and I could save the world someday, or at least a small corner of it. The problem solved itself, though, when she found a bauble-coveting second-year resident who liked to spin himself a role in her fantasies of opulent living and enviable social standing. What's ironic is that I did wind up spending a few years in private practice earning a lot of money, but not to spend the way she would have wanted. Then my sidekick and I moved back across the country to a bad neighborhood close to where we grew up. We opened a free clinic in the worst part of town. It's been quite successful. Me working day and night, saving and improving lives, my sidekick doing everything else and then some. He's proven near genius at hustling grants and donations, cajoling practitioners at all levels to volunteer their time, and negotiating discounts from providers. In this community, I've become the superhero, and though I'm not sure this is exactly the future that skinny little pest saw, I do think he's satisfied it was worth believing in me. I do know I wouldn't be who I am without him. Through it all, though, I've had one regret, and now I have two. The first, my success came too late for his mom. He sat in the corner and cried that day, and no amount of ice or band-aids or my threatening of bullies could help. If anything good could come from that, maybe it's that it infused us, with greater determination not to let that happen to others, especially the moms and dads of scared children who have to take charge when they should be the ones cared for. My second regret? I wasn't prepared for what just happened here tonight, and now the greatest ever superhero sidekick partnership is about to end. And now, I finally see the truth. I might call him sidekick, but this good-hearted young man has never been anything but simply my friend. That picked-on skinny little pest knew he wanted to grow up and help others, but he couldn't do it by himself, so he found one guy with the power to make it happen. The one guy who might not know it yet, but who, with a bit of help and lots of reminding, would grow into the kind of man who accepts and eventually embraces that role. The rare occasions he brought up that whole notion of becoming my sidekick, he always seemed matter-of-fact about it, never any doubt, proud that he would be the one. And it's breaking my heart to see it end like this. He stayed late, intending to sleep here in the clinic tonight because we've had break-ins and drug thefts. I came back with some late-night carry-out dinner to find him held at gunpoint. An instant of commotion, shouting, shots fired, and blood. Too much blood. Worse than a mere clinic can handle. Time too short. Thieves just grabbed the drugs and ran. And the truth in having the power to save lives means that you also know its limits. You know when a fully equipped trauma center is too far to reach in time, the blood coming too fast. And he's kneeling over me, and for the third time in all our years I see him crying, but I'm barely holding on, one hand inside myself, trying to stanch the flow to buy some minutes before I bleed out, the other hand clutching his arm, desperate to make him listen. But he won't, jerking free, calling 911, grabbing a tray of instruments. He's seen me do this. He's been my sidekick. My life insurance, I tell him, trying not to choke on the blood. Man, this hurts. You'll always, always have money. Liquid fire. And he cuts into me, turning me to drain the fluid, searching for bleeders, clamping, trying desperately to save me. Keep it. Keep going, clinic. Make others help. You can. Dizzy now. Tingling. Sirens in the distance. He's pushing fluids, trying to keep me from crashing. If you have to, I insist, floating now. You can do it without me. They're outside now. Maybe there is a chance. Still, I have to tell him just in case. He's got my head up, cradling it, whispering assurances. I try to reach for him, but my arm is numb, somewhere else. He looks me straight in the eyes like he always has, and I can't say it yet because he's telling me something. What's he telling me? What? I have one power, he's saying, and he believes it with all his heart. I can look inside people and see their powers, and what I've seen all along, we still got bigger things to do than this clinic. The police are inside now, all clear for the EMTs to enter. I'm fading into waves of tingles, but now I wonder if just maybe I'll be able to find my way. We got him, one voice says, lifting me up. You did all this? Cool air, flashing lights. Yeah, he got all the bleeders. Moving fast, siren. GSW to the chest. People helping others. Wow, Doc, you got lucky. Yeah. Back when I was just a regular suburban kid of 9 or 10, I got lucky. I can see him out there now, craning to watch, worried but confident. The one I depend on. Yes, there's something all superheroes should know. Sidekicks are heroes too.
There you have it, Sidekick, from the Stephen G's short story collection, Comes This Time to Float. That's one of my favorites, Stephen, from that collection. There's a few others that I really like too, but that's one of my favorites.
Well, thank you. That recording now can be heard in its entirety in the Fresh Ink Group channel over on YouTube. There's a few more other things there that you might want to listen to, along with watching all of our promos and stuff, too.
Yeah, and speaking of our promos, if you're an author and you would like a book trailer or even an audio commercial to run on this program, just let us know. This is what we do. Or one of the many things that we do, I should say. So we're nearing the end of the show, but we still have some time left. Any final thoughts?
Well, I'm not seeing a whole lot of activity on Twitter today, so we're going to have to push that a little bit harder next week. I think we enjoyed this format today. We want to try some different things with this show. We're liking the idea of continuing to interview authors and musicians, but maybe having them do a little bit of a reading or a book that's coming up or a short story or something like that, and then have an opportunity for you to interact with them. We're also looking for any ideas any of you listeners have. Just let us know.
Yeah, this show is kind of wide open right now, the whole format. We've talked about this before. So we're trying a lot of different things, and some of these are kind of cool. And like this one, I mean, I really enjoy the whole short story aspect here, sharing, you know, stuff that we've written, what other people have written, our thoughts on short stories. This is I think a great format, and we can, we can just, the sky's the limit. I mean, we can just build on it, and perhaps each week we got something a little different. You might not know what you have in store each week as it comes, kind of like a little gift bag.
We can tease you a little bit and say that in the next week or two, we're looking to have author Robert McKenzie. He's from Houston. And we just put out the first volume of his two-part book, The Chair, which is a very interesting historical fiction that runs from hundreds of years ago to almost 100 years into the future. So you fans of Robert McKenzie out there, spread the word, and we'll make sure that we get him on here in the next week or two.
Yeah, I've been fortunate enough to start, to do some of the work on the book trailer for that. And yeah, that definitely seems like a unique kind of book. It's historical fiction. It's futuristic. It's modern. It's got all these elements to it, and it's quite unique. So I'm looking forward to having him on, kind of pick his brain and see where these ideas came from. So, all right. I think we can wrap this up. We'll be back next week. Like we said, it may be something different. We may we'll probably have a guest on next week. We've got a few in line, in mind as well. So we'll let you guys know a day or two in advance, and that way you can mark it on your calendar. But I think that about does it for this week.
Well, thanks for listening, everybody. Make sure you spread the word, and we'd like to see you back next week. And maybe get some comments going on Twitter, and we can get those phone lines open again and let you talk to some of our authors and musicians we're going to have on. Thanks again.
Yeah, and if you missed it live, you can find it in the archives. We'll see you again next week, everybody, and thanks for tuning in.
This is Stephen Gies. Later.
You've been a part of Voice of Indie, a production of Fresh Ink Group. Spread the word, support our guests, then find us at freshinkgroup.com and be sure to hashtag Fresh Ink Group.